the Sparrowhawk pilots become so good that by 2 years into the Macon's program, by 26, they take the wheels off of the Sparrowhawks. They're like, look, we're never landing on the ground. We're going to land on the airship every time.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Hello, I'm Tyler Pitroff, and this is Preble Hall. Today I'm with United States Air Force Major Joe Ennett, who has been serving on the History Department faculty here at the United States Naval Academy for the last 3 years. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Tyler. It's great to be here.
Before I get into what we are specifically here to talk about today, I have to ask the question that's probably burning in everybody's minds, which is, what exactly is an Air Force officer doing at the Naval Academy?
I get that question more than I think I really want to necessarily, but I have a great time with it because nothing is more fun to me because I teach naval history, which is a freshman class. So you get all the plebes who are coming out of their plebe summer, and they've just been washed in navy blue and gold, and they come into their naval history class first thing in the fall, and bam, Air Force guy standing in front of them, and they're all absolutely confused. Like, they have no idea what's going on. That's one of my favorite moments. But I'm actually a naval historian. That's my actual, like, academic background. Both my bachelor's and my master's are heavily focused both in military history, but specifically within naval history. So it's kind of been an interesting experience being the guy in the wrong uniform, but actually the naval historian, because we've got a lot of folks on the faculty whom I love very deeply that are naval officers that are not military historians, much less naval historians.
So, Joe, why don't we start off with the basics? As we know, the first powered, heavier-than-air flight was conducted by the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur, near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, in 1903. Where does this... I know this is a vague place to start, but where does the Navy come into aviation? And I've, of course, intentionally left out the other major first for early aviation in 1901, which you're welcome to bring up.
Exactly where I was going to go, and that's the lighter-than-air aviation from the even the more modern aspect is still a 20th century invention. Old Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin was a Prussian, or not Prussian, he was just one of the other German states, but forgive me, I can't remember which one.
I think he was Bavarian.
That sounds
but
right.
But I might be off on that.
It was South Germany somewhere, but before the reunification, it was a mess. But he was, anyway, a military observer to the Union Army during the Civil War, and the Union Army actually had a balloon program. In fact, one of the first naval aviation, if you want to call it that, things was actually a U.S. Army balloon ship that they sailed down the harbor. It was called the George Washington Park Custer Lee. It was one of Washington's like grandkids,
and very long
who has like five or six
name.
Names. Yeah, mm-hmm. But anyway, they would basically tie a manned balloon to it. The guy would go up and do artillery spotting, find shell spotting, and yell back down to the folks who would then basically horse run a message to the artillery guns to adjust fire to put stuff on target. And Zeppelin saw this and was like, well, that's a great idea, but having it tied down is a terrible idea. So he wanted to find a way to make the balloon mobile and not dependent on the wind. So he goes back to Germany and in 1901 creates the first rigid airship, which gets named after him. That's where the Zeppelin comes from. And he actually builds it on the water. Doesn't build it on the land. He builds it on the water because the airship was huge. Despite its massiveness, it really only carried about 4 people and had a stunningly high top speed of like 3 knots. So it wasn't super effective. It was really kind of a cool
gadget.
Yeah, it was a proof of concept of a technology mm-hmm. that he put his own money into because he's a wealthy noble and he has the money to do that. But of course, it's not going to make great amounts of money himself, so he's trying to find a way to sell these things. So he, by the time he gets, after LZ-1, the first airship in 1901, sort of a proof of concept, by the time he gets to LZ-3, LZ-4, 1902, 1903, he's desperately trying to sell these things to the German government, hoping that he really wants the German army to buy him because he's still kind of tied to that, what he saw in 1863, 1864. Like, these have great aspects for scouting. And that has become, really a hallmark of early aviation, because even when the first airplanes are come about, you know, the heavier than air after 1903, by the time we really get to about 1907, 1908, functional aircraft for the military, actually it was 1907, August 1st of 1907, when the U.S. Army Signal Corps basically instituted the first airplane unit within the U.S. Army. And they had no idea what to do with the things. And it's one of the things that, it's the only Air Force-y thing about my historical aspects, is I love this idea of aviation in history because it runs so, maybe not counter, but against the grain of what we tend to think about when we consider technological revolutions in history. I love my freshman students, but it tends to be this idea that aviation burst into the military like Athena. Like it just jumps out of Zeus's forehead, fully formed, fully armed, and ready to mess shit up. And that's just not entirely accurate. I mean, they invented the airplane and they gave it to the army, and the army went, neat, what do we do with it? They had no idea. I mean, they first had it with the Signal Corps, it's a communications device. It was faster running messages. They were just hauling messages and cargo, basically. Not heavy cargo, paper cargo. And then they found a better use for them by integrating them with the cavalry in the pre-World War I era. The scouting mission. U.S. American cavalry had a very different use of cavalry than the British cavalry or the European cavalry, which were large, heavy, mobile units during warfare. In the U.S. aspect, cavalry was long-range scouting. So they were never used as a mainline combat in the way that they would be used in European warfare. So they instituted that with airplanes into the scouting mission.
And that's the famous role, if I recall correctly, of the incursion into Mexico.
Yep.
General Pershing using the aircraft in that role.
Exactly. And he used some airship support as well, but
and again, that was around 1914.
Yeah, and it wasn't really, they were more blimpish balloon type roles, but he was using them. But he used aviation to a much better effect in the punitive expedition against Pancho Villa. But from the naval aspect, aviation was even more confused because they invented the airplane and they wanted to sell them to the Navy, and the Navy was like, yeah, you know, we use boats, right? Like, what are we going to do with these things? So it was a much harder thing to integrate Navy or aviation into the Navy for the British Navy, the French Navy, and the American Navy, who are far much more entrenched in their, not necessarily naval superiority, but their naval doctrine and dogma. The Germans had a much different respect for how to integrate technology to get an advantage, especially in the naval domain, because while the German army was always one of the better armies in Europe, the German Navy was always in third place, and they knew it. And another one of these wonderful historical constants is when you're always the underdog, you innovate. You find ways to change the game necessarily. So while the German army did not want to buy Zeppelins, the German Navy did. And they ended up using them to much more considerable effect. And when the German army bought like 5 Zeppelins, but before the Great War starts, the German Navy bought something like 40. They were very interested in them because they were useful for scouting. So while
For context, we're talking, you know, the German Navy has the responsibility both for the North and Baltic Seas, which may not look tremendously huge on a map. However, the weather, especially in the North Sea, tends to be very treacherous and foggy and difficult to deal with, and the going theory then would be the airship would be above a lot of that and be able to see much more effectively and further. Apart from just being able to travel much faster than a surface ship would be able to.
Exactly. And there were the other aspects of, you know, the scouting ships, the faster destroyers, cruisers, or even some of the battle cruisers that were developed during the beginning of the First World War, were very much limited by their line of sight.
Right.
You know, the taller the tower, the further you can see across the horizon. There's a physics thing in the curvature of the Earth there. And that's where airplanes became an idea, that they could use those. But the seaplanes, which the British Navy was using and the German Navy was using by the time of the First World War, were difficult to launch. Seaplane tender had to stop, lower the thing onto the water. The water had to be calm enough for the plane to take off. Then it would have to go find the thing with a limited range and then return the message somehow. This is the days of when there was radio, but radio equipment was big and heavy, and these planes didn't carry a lot. The useful lift that you could get out of a hydrogen-filled airship was incredible. So they could carry heavier radio equipment. They could carry these. So whereas airplanes would tend to have to write messages, you know, on paper in waterproof capsules that float with a parachute and throw it over the side, and then the cruiser would come by and literally pick it up and read the message, the airship had the capability of sending messages direct. So when they were able to spot the fleet, they could put that message right back to the fleet much quicker. The case in point, Jutland. World's largest naval battle of all of World War I. And from the aviation aspect, there's, you know, Rutland of Jutland, right? The one British naval aviator who was able to get his seaplane up and wasn't able to do much at all. Mm-hmm. I don't think he even found the German fleet, or if he did, it was too late, or he only found half of it. Whereas the German naval zeppelins spotted Beatty and directly pushed that information down to,
Scheer was the High Seas Fleet commander at that time, yeah.
Yeah. But he was the Zeppelins were able to pass that information back. While that had a limited success role, they were most useful in spotting and hunting U-boats, or in submarines, rather. And that's where aviation gets its first major role within the Navy, is long-range scouting and U-boat hunting. And the airships occupy a very unique aspect of that. Because, again, aviation was new. So there's this debate. What's the future of aviation? Lighter than air, heavier than air? Is it, what's its role, especially within the Navy? The Germans, during the war, actually attempted to use some of the Zeppelins, the Army Zeppelins, as strategic bombers. In fact, they were the very first long-range strategic bombers. They put 1,000-pound bombs on these things and flew them over London and Birmingham and several just civilian cities. So the first city bombing is also the first strategic bombing. It's also the first long-range bombing, and it's done by Zeppelins. Now, it turns out that they're terrible bombers. And it's one of the most interesting things about this technology, about the airship technology, is that while it is several thousand pounds of aluminum structure and engines and people and gas and water and ballast and everything, by the time you fill the thing with hydrogen, it becomes, it's often called lighter than air, but in reality, it weighs zero. A properly ballasted airship, you can move with your own human power standing on the ground next to it. You can put your hand against it and push and move the thing. Because it weighs zero. It's called aerostatics, literally zero movement in air.
Hmm.
And that makes it one of the more complicated things of moving it. Because, you know, when we talk about airplanes, right, there's thrust, drag, and then there's lift, and there's gravity. Well, lift still exists, but gravity is kind of in the background. So it's all just lift and just thrust and drag. But it's a gas bag. So as you go higher, air pressure becomes less, gas bag inflates, you get greater lift. So you have to add weight. So that's where the ballast comes in. So you put more weight, it brings you back down, it keeps you at a good level, but let's say you fly into a pocket of cold air. Cold air is more dense, there's a higher pressure, the bag deflates. Now you start dropping. So you have to dump some of that ballast so that you get lighter, you go back up, and it's a constant balance just to keep yourself level. But you can't add weight in flight, so they tended to have some major issues with that sort of stuff. But when you talk about high-level bombing, strategic bombing with these things, the getting over the city wasn't a problem, dropping the bombs wasn't the problem. But what's the reaction? The greatest, you know, anti-Zeppelin defensive system that the British came up with was the searchlight. Literally, they turn on a searchlight. Ooh, there it is. I mean, it's moving at a pretty good clip. I mean, a Zeppelin could push 30 or 40 knots, but it's big. We're talking 200, 300 feet long. You can just see the thing moving and light it up with a searchlight and shoot at it. It's full of hydrogen.
It's not going to end well.
It's not going to end well.
In all likelihood.
That being said, getting a spark sometimes was very difficult, shooting stuff. I mean, I've seen the Mythbusters. You can shoot the gas tank all you want, but that doesn't mean it sparks, right?
Right.
But it's a gas bag. Punch enough holes in it, and doesn't matter how much ballast you dump, you're going down.
Right.
So they fly higher. to avoid the searchlights and then to avoid the anti-aircraft fire and then eventually airborne, air defense, fighter patrols. But as you go higher and higher, you get two problems. You get colder air, so you get a change in air pressure densities, but you also get higher winds. And it's gas bag. It's aerostatic. So the wind will move this thing all over the place unless you adjust basically your vector and your thrust. But at higher altitudes, higher winds, it's, and these things are not enclosed or pressurized cockpits, so the, you know, more German aeronauts died of exposure than died from being shot down, because it's negative 20 degrees in the upper levels of atmosphere while they're trying to drop bombs on London, and that's literally...
If they're even able to get over London in the first place.
I mean, yeah. Accuracy was essentially like, ooh, look, lights! Drop bombs and hope we hit something. They weren't aiming for any particular target whatsoever, so it really was just generic city bombing. So they weren't very good bombers. The Germans canceled that mission very, very quickly, and nobody ever went back to using the rigid airships as bombers. In fact, the armies didn't want to keep them for any reason. The only folks that continued to use them in the interwar period were navies and civilian passenger liners.
So before we get onto the Navy itself in the interwar period,
yes.
Just to encapsulate what you were just saying, World War One experience essentially is very heavily German with Zeppelins.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans have by far the most experience with Zeppelins. They understand them the best. They're able to discern their most effective uses. And essentially what they derive from that is they're useless as strategic bombers, as you said, or really as bombers of any kind.
Yes.
They're useful as reconnaissance platforms more than anything else, especially for naval reconnaissance over the North Sea for the Germans. The British and the French perceive this potential use for them against submarines. They also, of course, are only on the receiving end of the bombing raids. They are aware of some of the deficiencies of Zeppelins, inaccuracy being one, but they're not fully cognizant of the weaknesses of Zeppelins because they're simply not operating anything remotely as advanced as German airships during that period.
Correct.
So in the post-World War I period, you have this initial great interest in Zeppelins by the British, the French, and really the Americans as well, or at least some within the United States. And not quite as much on the German end, right? I mean, the German Zeppelin company itself, of course, is very interested in establishing civilian passenger service, which really, if I recall, was Zeppelin's dream to begin with.
Yes.
But beyond that, the Germans really have sort of had their fill of the problems military Zeppelins have had. So essentially what ends up happening is the British and the French impose, of course, this very far-reaching disarmament on the Germans in the Treaty of Versailles.
Correct.
And as part of that, they essentially strip the Germans of their ability to build airships, or they try to, and take many of the German airships as prizes. And
well, they try to.
Or try to.
Yeah.
But they end up charging, and I'm sorry if I'm jumping on your territory a little bit here, but they end up getting the Zeppelin company to help them build more airships, right? And that's how the Zeppelin company initially stays in business.
The Treaty of Versailles restricted the militarization of airships. They weren't even allowed to keep an air force under the treaty. So, but the airship companies were still allowed to make airships. However, part of the reparations, I mean, in the same way that the British and the French were dividing up the German High Seas Fleet, which was interred at Scapa Flow, until like the day before they signed the treaty in Paris, and they scuttled the entire fleet. Well, somewhat of the same thing is happening with the airships. The British, the French, and the Americans have doled out some of the remaining German military airships as reparations. And to basically try and do the same thing that the High Seas Fleet did and scuttle themselves, the Zeppelin company, or the German military operators of the German military Zeppelins, put them to the torch. You know, they're filled with hydrogen. They burn pretty quickly. So they just burned them all down in the hangars rather than give any over to the Allies. And the British and the Germans, or excuse me, the British and the French were mostly like, yeah, okay. I mean, we're not pleased about that, but we can let those go. The Americans, they stood on that one. Even though the Senate never really ratified the Treaty of Versailles, they still went back to him and said, no, you owe us an airship. And we basically made a huge deal out of it to try and force the Germans into building an airship. And that's what we got. The first U.S. Navy airship was actually built by the Germans, built by the German Zeppelin Company, as a passenger liner. It was a converted passenger liner. And that raised some interesting issues because it was built by a civilian company as a civilian craft and then was given to the Americans free of charge as a war reparation. But because it was built as a civilian craft by a civilian agency under the Treaty of Versailles, we were not allowed to weaponize it. So the first airship in the U.S. Navy, the USS Los Angeles, was a testbed platform. We never carried an offensive armament of any kind. It was just the first airship that we tried to figure out what to do with. At the same time, we were building an airship. Our first domestically built airship, which becomes the USS Shenandoah. A lot gets made out of the airships and this idea that they were inherently dangerous because of the hydrogen. That's what made the Hindenburg so spectacular. But that's not why America wanted to use helium. Helium is an interesting gas, whereas hydrogen, you can make hydrogen. In fact, that's how the Zeppelins were filled. That's how balloons were used in the field during really all the way up until World War I and then even into World War II with barrage balloons. They were filled with hydrogen because hydrogen is fuel expedient. A big truck filled with iron plates, basically. They would pour sulfuric acid into it. Sulfuric acid and the iron oxides melt away, release free hydrogen atoms, and bloop, 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 tie it off, balloon. Hydrogen's free. You can make it. Helium can't make. Helium is a product of the petroleum industry. It's a natural gas that comes out of the petroleum industry. Well, in the early, before World War II, or before the end of the Second World War, the United States is the world leader in petroleum production and export. So we have 90 to 95% of the world's complete supply of helium. However, it was not enough helium in the strategic reserve of the United States to fill both the Los Angeles and the Shenandoah. So by 1923, when we have the first two Zeppelins in the U.S. arsenal, we can only fly one of them at a time. If they wanted to fly the Shenandoah, they had to dock them both next to each other and pump the gas out of the Los Angeles into the Shenandoah. And that introduces one of the first problems that dooms the airships for the Americans. America has stuff that Europe doesn't have, namely weather. Love my European brethren. I spent time in England, I've spent time in Germany, and I love it to death, but thunderstorm ain't a thing there. Or it is, but it's very rare. They don't have tornadoes. They don't get lake effect snow. Ireland and Scotland may get the tail end of an Atlantic hurricane every few years, but they don't get the high winds of the plains. They don't get lake effect snow. They don't get hurricanes and Tornado Alley and the... Once we start talking about flying a Zeppelin from Norfolk to San Diego, like we're going, from the coast over Appalachia into the over the Mississippi Valley, then into the Midwest, into the plains, over the Rockies, over Death Valley, and then over the Cascades into sunny California coast. That's a lot of different climates and weather systems and temperatures and things that really messed with these airships that had very, very tight controls on temperature variances and atmospheric pressures and wind. And in a hydrogen airship, you could vent the hydrogen and it wouldn't be that big a deal. If you in an emergency situation, you needed to go low quick, you could vent hydrogen. Heck, if you had the equipment on board, you could make more hydrogen. Can't do that with a helium airship. You vent that helium, it's gone. And like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of spare helium to work with. So with the first transcontinental crossing for the Shenandoah, I want to say in late 23, from Norfolk to San Diego, when they were going over the Rockies, they were at a pressure, basically a pressure barrier, where the only way they could keep altitude was to get over the Rockies was to lose lift. They had to dump helium. Captain Lansdowne didn't want to lose all that helium because he knew he had to come back. So they ended up finding a pass through the Rockies that had a low enough altitude, and they basically, like nap of the earth, flew this thing at less than 100 feet off the deck through a mountain pass to keep the altitude as low as possible so that they didn't have to vent gas. Like, that's how difficult things got with these airships.
For a naval airship, you could very much make the argument of, yes, that is an extreme weakness, but why should the Navy make these airships fly from coast to coast in the first place? Like, yes, in a lot of ways, you have to transfer equipment from one coast to another. That's the nature of having missions on two different oceans. But for a ship that is designed or at least intended as a naval scout, it should only really have to be well-adjusted for scouting over the ocean, right? So that begs the question of why did the Navy feel compelled to pull a stunt like sending an airship all the way across the United States and through the Rockies?
Logistics issues. So the airship, I mean, you're correct, but in the same way that if we had to transfer stuff from the Atlantic Fleet to the Pacific Fleet, they could go through the Panama Canal, but they have to go through the Panama Canal. If we could cart the thing in a straight line across the states and save time, money, and energy, and gas, we would. We can't. Physical problems there. To fly it over the sea, though, well, there's this other problem with the logistics issues, because as you use gas, the gas is on board. It weighs a certain amount. As you burn it...
And we're talking gasoline.
Yeah, gasoline. Yeah, the diesel for the engines. Well, as you burn that diesel off, the craft gets lighter. So you have both that concern of adding weight to the ship and therefore limiting the length of its flight without stopping for either an additional ballast or refueling of some kind. And despite, you know, a longer range, if you fly it over the sea, you have to stop several times to refuel it and refit it. And the logistics concerns for these things are huge. Because, remember, it weighs zero. So if you just leave it out in the open and it gets windy, you lose your airship. So that's why you have to tie it to those mooring masts. But you can't just tie it to a mooring mast and leave it there and lock it down to the ground. Because if the wind comes across the airship, it can damage it. So it has to be basically tied to this thing and basically freewheeling, like a big weather vane. So for however long your airship is, if your airship is 300 feet, or in the case of Hindenburg, 375 feet, you have to have a circle with a 375-foot radius available free and clear of all obstruction for the airship to be tied up to. So as the wind moves, it just moves with the wind like a big weather vane and always stays pointed into the wind. So there's only so many places that these things can even land. And if you need to get it out of the wind, you have to build a shed for it. And the shed has to be big enough to fit these things in. And these things are enormous, enormously big.
There's another aspect to why does the airship, especially, I believe you were talking about the Los Angeles, why does the Los Angeles get sent cross-country? Well, there's a publicity interest in this, mm-hmm. too. And it's very, very important. And that ties back into, of course, Moffitt. And how does Moffitt fit into this? So let's take this a little bit around to the perspective of Moffitt himself. Who is Moffitt? Where does he come from? Why is he important?
So Admiral William Moffitt is the Navy's first chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics. Like everybody in the early age of aviation, not an aviator by trade. He was a surface officer. In fact, he's one of the, he actually had a Medal of Honor that he got actually in the 1914 incursion into Veracruz, Mexico, during the Mexican Revolution. Navy goes ashore there, and he snuck his ship in with no running lights under the cover of darkness. Great risk to him and his crew, and had him there at dawn, in time, in the right position to put rounds on target when they called for fire during the incursion. After the war, though, after the Great War, when you get folks like Billy Mitchell, who, as an airman, I feel bad saying that I'm not a fan of Billy Mitchell, but I'm not. I don't like the man. He's one of history's many, many folks that were too much in love with the sound of their own voice. But that's my own problem with Billy Mitchell. But he very much believed that air power was the future of everything. And literally, he advocated for that with a well-funded and fully armed air service. We would not need a Navy to protect the coasts. The Air Force could do that. We do not need an army because air power could win the war before we'd ever have to put troops on the ground. Obviously, he's wrong about that. By the time he gets to this idea of, well, the Navy doesn't need to exist to sink the other Navy. Air power can do that. And that's when the bombing experiments on the Virginia coast come out in 1921, when he says, look, I can sink a battleship using airplanes. And sure, he does, with 3 days and four bombing runs and about 16,000 pounds of ordnance.
And oh yes, the battleship was anchored at the time.
Not shooting back. Yeah, a whole lot of problems with that. So this whole issue shows up between the services and how aviation is going to work, but the Navy admits that there's something to this, so they invest in this aviation idea. Now, it's a little out of sequence. The Navy understood that they were going to have to invest in aviation, but they weren't sure how and why, because the Navy has already ordered its first aircraft carrier. It's actually ordered in 1919. The Collier Jupiter goes into dock in 1920 and is finally commissioned in 1922 as the first aircraft carrier, the Langley. And that's the Navy's first heavier-than-air experiment. We've gotten our first lighter-than-air experiment around the same time. And it is also the same time when Moffett becomes the chief of the newly established Bureau of Aeronautics to manage this aviation nonsense for the Navy. So he becomes the first guy who's saddled with this problem of what is the future of aviation for the Navy? Is it the heavier-than-air aircraft? I have my aircraft carrier. Or the lighter-than-air aircraft? I have my Zeppelins. Which is going to be more effective for scouting or not? And he is presented with a lot of problems. Now, there's the strategic and tactical problems, the effectiveness of both pieces of equipment. But as the guy, as the admiral in charge of, you know, the policy level of these sort of things, he also has the budgetary things, the crewing, the training, the manpower aspects of these things. There are equally difficult training regimens for the airship crews and the aircraft carrier crews, the actual aviators of the airplanes, and then eventually the same thing when we talk about that for the aircraft or for the airships. But there's a whole lot of other things. For instance, an airship costs about half as much as an aircraft carrier does. It has a significantly greater range, several thousand nautical miles of range, and at a higher speed. Langley was one of the, certainly one of the slower aircraft carriers, but good speed for an aircraft carrier, World War II aircraft carrier, other than the purpose-built fast carriers, was still in the 20 knots, 25 knots. Airships were pushing 60, 70 knots. So they were higher speed with a greater range, and they cost less money. They took less crew, all sorts of benefits. Their biggest limiting factor was the helium.
And if I can interject as well, they had a similar role at the time to the aircraft carrier as well, specifically scouting, because aviation as a whole in the Navy was still intended first as scouting for the battle line.
Correct.
Throughout at least the early portion of this period, right? So this really is direct competition. This isn't just a comparison and just for the sake of it. Yeah.
And that was really, I want to say, the genius of Moffett, if you will, was he didn't know what the future was going to be. He wasn't sure which one was going to be. So rather than go through the complex studies and try to really war game out these scenarios, he basically went with a great taste, less filling. Let's do both. Let's pit them against each other and see which one will win. And this was where aviation really factors into the major fleet exercises of the interwar period, all the fleet problems. And aviation's roles in the fleet problems were manifold, but they often involved both the heavier-than-air aircraft carriers and the lighter-than-air airships, desperately trying to figure out which one of these was going to work. Moffett, while he is considered the father of naval aviation, thinking about that much more in the broader sense, he is the father of naval aviation, but he was not a believer in the heavier-than-air. He actually was the strongest advocate for the airship. He felt the future was in the airship, a lot because he could build, crew, train, and sustain more airships than he could aircraft carriers. He just had to figure out how to make them work with the fleet better. But that's when they start getting beset by major problems. The first is the crash of the Shenandoah. The date is specifically escaping me right now. I want to say 24. The Shenandoah crashes over Ohio. And just one of these things that happens in the plains, there's a change of wind gust. A big updraft hits the tail of the Shenandoah and sends the tail of the Shenandoah skyrocketing upward. We're talking about lifting upwards tail first at about 200 feet a second. Like it is shooting straight up. And as it's going up, you're hitting a lower pressure. The bags are inflating, so it's going up at an even greater velocity. They have to dump gas. They're trying to dump ballast as quick as possible while all the gear is falling forward. And they get that, they start bringing the ship back down, but now it's crashing too quickly almost, so they're trying to dump all the ballast to make it, to make it lighter, and it ends up working, but working too well, and it shears the thing in half.
Overcorrection problem.
Yeah. Dramatic, but there was nothing, there was no better exactly. way for them mm-hmm. to do it, but it shears it in half. The control car, which was suspended under the bow by like a ladder that they had to climb down into the control car, is flung clear of the bow section. Captain Lansdowne was in the control car, so he dies on impact. So Lansdowne is dead. The first captain, the real leader of the airship industry here for the Navy, he dies on impact. The whole bow section crashes. The sole remaining officer, the navigator who was in the tail section, Charles Rosendahl, whatever crew he has in there, he has them literally with their pocket knives slashing gas bags to start venting because the controls are gone. So that's how he's venting gas where he needs to basically free balloon the tail section back down to the ground at a reasonable speed and velocity. And everybody in the tail section survives. It's still not many, but the Shenandoah is gone, along with all of that helium. So the Los Angeles isn't flying anywhere anytime soon. So they're doing a lot of ground testing with that. And where Moffett sees the future for these airships is the best part of the aircraft carrier is the airplane. The aircraft carrier is a bus. Its sole job is to move airplanes. Without the airplanes, the aircraft carrier is a very silly looking ship that's very open to attack.
As is the airship,
yes. But the airship was never supposed to be a frontline unit of any kind. But to be fair, neither was the aircraft carrier.
But the problem they encounter is if you are scouting with the airship, there is a chance that you will find yourself within shooting range in some capacity
Correct.
Of the ships you are searching for.
So Moffett, once again, great taste, less filling, says, I want to marry the airplane and the airship. So he starts experimenting with ways to connect these two. And that's the Los Angeles becomes the first testbed for that of the underbelly trapeze system. So Indiana Jones and Last Crusade. When Indy climbs down into the airplane, hanging off the bottom of the Zeppelin, and then releases this little latch and it flies away off the bottom of the thing. That was what Moffett came up with. They had this really goofy-looking trapeze system that extended under the belly of the Los Angeles, and they hooked a Vought VO2 airplane to it with a big overwing trapeze system that the pilot could release by hand and would basically fall away, and hopefully the engine was working and they would take off and flying. They couldn't recover. It was never meant to be like carry it, but again, the Los Angeles couldn't do that because it was by treaty restrictions unable to be a weapon of war. So Moffett works with the Bureau of Ships to build two new domestic U.S. Navy airships that have encompassed all the things that they found wrong and all the best things that they can do to make new airships. And until the Hindenburg, these were the largest airships ever built. And we built two of them, the USS Macon and the USS Akron. And they encompassed all the tech that we could have had. The propellers were actually vectorable. So not just static propellers, but they could actually be rotated to point down or outboard or even up if necessary. So they were able to start using the engines to both increase or decrease lift as necessary. The first vectored thrust was not the F-22, it was the Macon and the Akron. Above the engines, when you see the pictures of the Macon or Akron, one of the most visually distinct features are what look like windows, these big lines of screens above the engines. Those are actually condensers designed to catch the heat exhaust, the heat radiation from the engines, and recapture that as basically a heat differential and condensed water so that they could add water ballast just using the engine exhaust and thermal emissions. Ram scoops on the top of it, so if they flew through clouds, they could collect water vapor to add ballast. They solved the how do I add weight issue. It was also considerably larger with a way better range, but they sacrificed some space in it. Where one of the cells should be is hollow. And they actually built a hangar inside the Macon and the Akron, where they would hang aircraft. Not many, maybe five or six aircraft, basically hanging like meat hooks from the interior structure with a crane that could pick them up, lower them to the trapeze. The crew would hop in, they'd lower the trapeze, they'd turn the engine on like Indiana Jones, drop away, fly off. So before SHIELD has a helicarrier, the U.S. Navy had flying aircraft carriers. That was Moffett's brainchild. He said the heavier-than-air airplane is the solution for scouting, but the airship was the solution for the aircraft carrier. Said it was away from the fleet, it wasn't part of the thing, it had better range, better speed, and could cover more ground scouting than the aircraft carrier could with the fleet. Because the aircraft carrier could not advance beyond the fleet. Even though it needed to do scouting, it would put itself in danger moving beyond the fleet. Well, the airship was not going to ever be protected by the fleet very well anyway, so it knew it was going to go forward. Its benefit was that the airplanes did the scouting, and it stayed far enough back. So it covered way more ground. And that was played out in the fleet problems, too. When they start using the Macon and the Akron in the fleet problems in 24 and 25, they were actually able to find the enemy fleet before the heavier-than-air ships, the heavier-than-air aircraft carrier ships were. Where the first issues start coming in between, you know, really this debate between the aircraft carrier and the airship aircraft carrier was there were only two of the aircraft of the airships. By the late 20s, we got three aircraft carriers, the Saratoga, the Lexington, and the Langley, and we're starting to build more. We want to build more of these airships as well, but then we come into another problem. The crash of the Akron was devastating for several reasons. One, it was preparing to go down to a fleet problem in the Panama Canal, which was, you know, these things went everywhere the fleet problems went, and the fleet problems were always arranged around the most strategic aspects of whatever needed to be defended within America. So they went to the Philippines, they went to Guam, they went to Hawaii, they went to the Panama Canal, East Coast, West Coast, and Alaska. Prepping to go down to the Panama Canal, they're doing their spin-up operations off the coast of New Jersey, and Admiral Moffett goes aboard to do the inspection. And they get hit with a sudden temperature shift that drops the ship real fast. And they dump a ballast to start coming back up, but the weather closes in and there's a downdraft on the tail. The tail gets slammed into the ocean. The rear fin shears away, the skin's now open to the water, so they jam the throttle full open, they dump ballast, and they try to get lift off the ship as much as possible, but the tail's full of water. All that weight is now creating way too much tension on the airframe, and the tail shears off. So all four tail fins shear off, it's now rudderless, it's out of control, and you've lost several gas bags, they get cut, and it plummets into the ocean. In New Jersey, in, I want to say, April. It's cold. Soon as the thing hits, the water rushes through the control car and it washes three guys out to sea, including Charles Rosendahl, who was, I think, still the navigator. And those three guys are the only people that survive. Everybody on the Akron dies, including Admiral Moffett. Of the, I want to say, 70-some-odd, I think 76 aboard, only three survive. It's a devastating loss. It's a new airship. Moffett, who was the champion of the airship, is gone. And the guy who replaces him as the chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, this guy named Ernest King, is not a fan of the airship. He believes in the fleet, and the fleet needs to be, he's very old school Mahanian in that concept. The fleet remains concentrated. You can't scatter it by giving it something like an airship that goes far away from the fleet. Keep the fleet together. Consolidation of force. So he's not very pro-airship. He sees them as expensive and dangerous. Because every time we lose an airship, we lose all that helium. And that helium is expensive. The only airship left, the just recently commissioned Macon, and the Los Angeles, which can't be a weapon of war. So we're down to one airship in the U.S. Navy. And while the Macon is very, very good, in fact, the aviators ditch the Vought VO2 and bring in a new aircraft, the F-9C Sparrowhawk. It's a smaller, more tight fighter with a much greater range and capabilities. And the pilots get very, very good. The Sparrowhawk pilots become so good that by 2 years into the Macon's program, by 26, they take the wheels off of the Sparrowhawks. They're like, look, we're never landing on the ground. We're going to land on the airship every time. So they ditch the wheels from the undercarriage entirely and add an external fuel tank. So the first external fuel tank is an F-9C Sparrowhawk in the 20s attached to a Zeppelin. And then they actually designed the tank the way they can drop the tank away if they need to. By losing the wheels, adding the tank, increasing the fuel usage, they actually extend the range of the aircraft by an incredible amount. It's one of the things I love historically is I can date pictures of the make-in based on whether the Sparrowhawks have wheels or not. Because once they don't have wheels, I know exactly what time frame I'm looking at here. That's how good they were. And they had made excellent strides both in terms of their effectiveness with scouting with the fleet and their public relations campaign, which was always a big deal for the airship industry, for the airship world. Going so far as to when President Roosevelt was out on his, because, you know, of course, they had presidential yachts. You know, he had his own Navy ship that would take him places, which I think was the Baltimore, actually, wasn't it? Don't take me to court on that one. The Sparrowhawk pilots actually located it and drop a message for the president. Best wishes from the crew of the Macon, but we found you.
Not bad.
Not bad. I mean, great PR for the at that level, especially because Roosevelt's very much a Navy man. He is very impressed by that. They wanted to put more money into the airship program to try and keep these alive, even though there was still this great debate over what's more effective for scouting. Without Moffett, King in charge, he saw the waste of, you know, there's been two crashes. They were both spectacular, and they were both horribly damaging
and very deadly for their crews.
And very, very deadly for the crews, exactly. And, you know, one of them killed the admiral. You know, we can go back in history. Was it 1842 when the gun on the Princeton explodes? When the Peacemaker explodes and kills the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of State and the gun captain and three colonels and a whole bunch of spectators. Like, steam power, big gun evolution, and the propeller, which had nothing to do with the gun but was on the USS Princeton as part of the technological innovation, sets that innovation back decades. The same problem happens with the airships. And then the Macon crashes too. Much different scenario. They're off the coast of California, off Big Sur, when a shift in wind drafts across the tail and rips one of the tail fins free, slices an airbag, and they start losing control on the tail again. Tail collapses underneath the stress of that high wind, snaps the frame, and it starts going down as well. Luckily, the water off Southern California is considerably warmer and nicer than it is off of, you know, New Jersey in the spring. And they had plenty of time, and much in the sad way that when the Titanic sank, everybody went, oh God, we need more lifeboats for everybody. Well, the crew of the Macon had enough gear on board to go, oh, what happens if we go down in the water? So they were able to throw out life jackets and life rafts and everything out of the bottom of the thing so that once it hit the water, everybody just swam to a life raft. So of the, like, 78 on board, only three, so rather than three survive, only three die. So much better thing, but we still lose the airship.
At this point, left with is the Los Angeles, right?
Correct. All they're left with is the Los Angeles, which you can't use as a weapon of war. The taste for spending money on these things, congressionally speaking, is gone. Because now we're looking at the beginning of the Great Depression.
Right, because this is early 30s we're talking about.
Yeah,
at this point.
This is Macon would have been 26 to 30, I want to say 32, 31.
And it's amazing what high-profile disaster will do for congressional taste for additional spending.
Yes. Now, with the, you know, because, and therein lies the difference. Shipbuilding is a big industry in America, always has been. Jobs were able to be made by shipbuilding to build some, you know, to build aircraft carriers, to build battleships. The airship was like a precision technology that was only being built by like two companies. And
not often.
Either. And not often. And one of them was Goodyear. That's why it's the Akron and the from Ohio, and in Akron, Ohio is where the airship hangars live, and that airship hangar is the next to the headquarters of Goodyear, because the skin that was made for these things had to be made of a very specific rubber process that was made by Goodyear Tire and Rubber. Goodyear gets most of its initial government contracting from building the airships. The duraluminum, a very specific type of aluminum that we use for the frames, and the skin, the doping, all of it was made by Goodyear Company. Well, Goodyear is able to make more money selling tires to the burgeoning automobile industry than they are making airships. So there's no commercial interest for building these things. There's no taste in government for building these things. And in the Navy, the Bureau of Aeronautics under King doesn't want them.
And fortunately, the scout bomber idea ended up working out pretty well for the United States Navy.
It did. With a lot of luck and some...
And a fairly good design.
The irony of that is that the scout aviation role in the Navy during the Second World War was one of the most crucial, but it was never done by the aircraft carrier. It was actually done by a combination of seaplanes launching from several of the islands that were captured in the island hopping campaign and bombers. U.S. Army Air Force's B-17s were purchased by the Navy and turned into long-range scout platforms. And they were incredibly effective at long-range scouting for the fleet. So scout aviation is a crucial role, really, until radar is fully evolved at the end of the war, right, going into the 50s and then into the Vietnam era. As radar becomes more fully evolved, we don't have to use scout aviation as much. But scout aviation ends up becoming part of everything. To this day, U.S. Navy cruisers, the larger destroyers and the old frigates carry their own Seahawk helicopters. They're part of an aviation asset to extend the range, both visual and reconnaissance-wise, of the ship at sea. All of that goes back to, what do we do with aviation? How do we use both the airplane or the airship? How do we figure out which one the future was going to be? One of my favorite photos is the Los Angeles actually landing on the aircraft carrier Saratoga. It's this perfect image of nobody knew what to do with these things. Ironically enough, they are making something of a comeback in the modern era as heavy lift vehicles, because they have an incredible lifting power, and so they're able to reach places that we can't get via road and carry enormous amounts of lift. The problem still is weather. They're great in places that don't have the problems that the continental United States has. Well, I should say all the United States has. Various climates and weather systems and an expansive territory, amount of land that just doesn't lend itself to effective airship operations.
Well, Joe, thank you for sharing that with us. That was fun. So hopefully we'll have another opportunity to talk a little bit of weird history.
Glad to. I love the randomness of stuff, because that's what always makes it more interesting.
And ultimately, that's why we're all here. So,
exactly.
Well, thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll have more interesting history for you in the near future. Until then.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.